So, good morning, good afternoon. Can you hear me? No, it's not great. Maybe we could turn up the sound or something.
Or maybe to be closer.
Closer?
Or maybe that, just move that.
Just in front of
me. I know. It's like. Is that better? Can you hear better?
I don't have to look at it straight.
Okay. So, good morning, good afternoon. For our first day of practice of the season. And as I said yesterday in the study group, we're in my house, which we have not done a day here for a long, long time. Many years, I think. So that's also interesting. And the last time we did it here, we certainly did not do it online as well. It was way before COVID. It's a new place, a new group, new day. The sun has blessed us here, so we've been able to be in the garden, which is wonderful. This morning, as I was, or maybe it was last night, I don't know, thinking about today and what maybe we could talk about, I just happened upon a couple of things, but one of them was video clips of this man who was assassinated in the United States a couple of weeks ago. This right wing, it was an article in the New York Times analyzing how he used debate techniques in his meetings with young college, idealistic college students, right? That was his target audience. And he, you know, he was a skilled debater and he used all these debating techniques, which I don't really know much about debate, but when I read the article, it made sense and they gave clips to show the examples of what he was doing. And what struck me, which I already knew, but it became clear in reading that, was that he had this, you know, overriding goal, and because he was so convinced of his goal, whatever he never wavered from that goal. And we can agree with his goal or not, and that's not really what my point is today, but it was that this absolute determination to achieve that goal. And so, you know, refined his argument and basically presented his talks were called Prove Me Wrong. So he was in this very powerful position of sitting there with these thousands and thousands of students there, and they would one by one come up to the microphone and ask him a question. And he, before the meeting started, they would ask people if they had questions, and then they would filter them so that they addressed issues that he wanted to talk about. And he tried to have ones from both sides. But he loved it when there were people asking questions who didn't agree with him. Because he was so convinced of his arguments that he knew they could not prove him wrong. Okay, this was basically what it was. And he often ended up humiliating the people, making them look ridiculous in front of this huge crowd. And because they were not equipped like he was, because he knew what his arguments were, everything. Anyway, in one of these clips, he said, college is a waste of time and money. Going to university in America is a waste of time and money, because what you learn there will not make America competitive with China. And I get, maybe someone questioned him about that to be more precise, and he said, yeah, and he throws out these statistics that aren't really even factual, but you know, the majority of students study social sciences and humanities, which is not true, and none of that will help us compete with China. And he's the one that he, then the New York Times showed that he repeated this line over and over and over again throughout his things. He said, what good is it to study North African lesbian poetry? And he said, we have far too many people in our universities studying North African lesbian poetry, right? That will not help us compete with Chinese, China. And so, and they had like a number of clips where he used this, often he uses the same lines, right? But the students don't know that because this is the first time they've seen him, and, you know. And so I thought about that, and I thought, wow, you know, I don't even, if I had been that student, I would say, wow, I don't know anything about North African lesbian poetry. Can you tell me what those authors are? Or can you cite one of those poems? Or which country in North Africa are you talking about? You know, frankly, I don't think he would have been able to answer that question, you know. So I thought about that. Why that? I don't even think that exists as a thing, you know, but because it's three, you know, elements that are terrifying for him, you know, for terrifying for any kind of objective, which is to fill up, accumulate, gain, which is, you know, this race with China is to become bigger and better and have more power, more money, more influence, you know, so that you can have more money and more power. And so if you break down that phrase that he's using, well, poetry is like terrifying. Poetry is like, you know, the, you know, even music is less so, but, you know, an expression of the ungraspable, the invisible, you know, it's like pure emptiness or something like that. So that's terrifying if you're trying to fill up and accumulate.
There's no money in it, right?
Yeah. And there's no money in it, of course, because it's not about accumulating and whatever. Lesbians, same thing, right? They don't fit with the ideology of, you know, the very dualistic, black and white, man, woman, heterosexual.
Procreation.
Okay, we could go there too. Procreation. You know, lesbians theoretically don't have babies, although they do. But not in the way that he, you know, if you're thinking of it just in the, you know, the dualistic way of seeing the world. And so that is just like ridiculous for his, in his scheme of things. And then North African, because it's something obscure, that Africa is like to be exploited.
And they're black.
Well, not necessarily.
No, but in the Americans or African,
right,
were already.
Right. So
they're not white.
You know, so in that same polarized world, you know, it's a continent to be exploited, and North Africa is even more obscure than like
Africa.
Kenya or, you know, South Africa or something. It's like, North Africa? What's that for the American mentality? Mm-hmm. And so this is like, so this led me to emptiness and form, right? And that, and also this notion of our practice is, I mean, we are completely dedicated to an objective, if you will, as well, which is to realize the true nature of being, to realize the true nature of life, of all things, to see the oneness, right? And in that sense, we are as determined as he is. However, what we are seeking is not the same thing he's seeking. And I'm just using him as an example. We could say most of our culture is engaged in not seeking what we're seeking, right? Because most of our culture is involved with not experiencing emptiness at all cost. I mean, fill it up so we don't experience it. And what happens is we, like, there's a lot of ways of expressing this, but like we, because we are covering up and filling up who we truly are, then we can't possibly see it, but we will never be satisfied because it will never fully cover it up. So it's like we empty ourselves by filling ourselves up. We
hungry
empty
ghost,
ourselves.
Yeah. Huh? The hungry ghost.
Exactly,
syndrome.
Something like that, right? So we just, it's never enough. And even in French, you know, we say, you know, when we're like overworked, super saturated, too much to do, burnout, you know, vide. We'll say it like vide, I'm empty. But it's not the empty of the true, who we truly are, emptiness as we call it. And it became so clear to me when I, like, his whole thing was crystallized in that, prove me wrong, you know, as if he can have an opinion, sure. You know, and somebody else can have an opinion, and it's not that one is right or wrong and that we have to argue about it, you know. In fact, his thing with competing with China on a cultural level, historic cultural level, China's way ahead of the West because they have centuries and centuries and centuries of this practice of Taoism and Confucianism and a complete, even though, you know, the government of China doesn't follow these practices, it's a very, it's embedded in who they are, you know, and their way of being in the world is nothing like, you know, the way of Western being in the world. If he truly wanted to compete with China, well, this is the practice to do it, you know. Embrace rather than reject. But of course, then that's no longer a competition. But the competition is part of the problem, that we're fighting rather than embracing. So I was looking at that. And so then I started thinking about, you know, emptiness and form and what all of that. So I just was making some quick notes this morning. Not much time. You know, and even the thing is, so, you know, if... So I think if we come from that argument of him, of his argument, and what he represents and what our culture at large generally represents, what is missing from that viewpoint is that emptiness is not a thing. No, it's not a, it's, you know, it's like the, how could we say it? I wrote some things down here. It's like, it, you know, it's not a thing, even a negative thing. It's like, it's the nature, it's the operating factor of being, something like that. And in that sense, you know, it's the place of full potentiality, not the place of nothing, which we say this all the time. It sounds great, but do we really experience it? Well, you know, we have this koan, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. And this is a challenge to look at that one. But if we think of emptiness as like the impersonal and form as the personal, then it's maybe more clear that, and like we give this example of when we do any ritual, you know, we all bow together, we all walk together, we all chant together, orioki, you know, just to talk about our forms that we do, our rituals here, we all do the same thing at the same time. The personal is not what is the target. It's the impersonal. It's to join together as one to do the same thing. And that's the point of the rituals, to help us let go of the personal, how we want to sing, how we want to eat, how we want to sit, how we want to look, when we want to stand, when we want to walk, how we want to walk, where we want to walk, you know. So the Jikido is responsible for telling us the time, the walking, coming back, and all of that. But it's not out of personal position that that is being done. That is like occupying this seat that is involved with helping us all to experience the impersonal through these rituals. And there was once, I've told this story, I think, before, we did this retreat at a school in Portugal. I don't even remember where it was. It was the last time we did a week-long retreat in Portugal that wasn't in the summer, because we tried to do it at Easter time and very few people came. But the Jikido was, some of you, maybe Miguel and Tiago remember Luisa. Right. Definitely Tiago remembers Luisa. And she, so there was only maybe like, I don't know, 10 people at the retreat. And so she had asked me, so for the Kinhin, what can we do? And I said, we can go outside, you know, and there wasn't really anywhere to go. There's some images of that Kinhin in our slideshow from our 20 years, but it was like outside in this place. There was like a walkway that was enclosed in glass, and then there was a little courtyard and a terrace. And, so I said, you can go outside. Yes, of course. Well, then, so she took everyone outside. But then she didn't walk. When she came back in the zendo, she would like zigzag across the zendo and then reverse the direction. And she really took it upon herself to be this like innovative Jikido. And I sometimes wasn't there, so I didn't realize that's what this was happening. And then once I came, and I what? And that's an example of, you know, the Jikido imposing their personal, not engaging in the emptiness practice of the impersonal, but imposing the personal. As soon as I told her, please don't do that, she was fine and she didn't do it. But she didn't argue and say, oh, would I like to do it this way? Although I think she did like to do it that way. And that's an example of when, so we can see the difference there between just doing, just impersonal, holding this impersonal space and acting from that. Of course, each Jikido has their own way of ringing the bell, although they're trying to all ring it the same way. And they each have their own way of saying prepare for Dharma talk, although we're all trying to say it the same way. This is an expression of the impersonal. We're trying to engage in the impersonal, the emptiness, right? And when we, so North African lesbian poetry is like trying to put, you know, this like very personal label and trying to put everything as a personal label and not wanting to experience the impersonal, right? It's all about, you know, very powerfully expressing my view, prove me wrong, me versus you, China versus America. You know, this guy, he himself dropped out of a college when he, after his first year, because he wanted to do this, what he's doing now, what he was doing until he was assassinated. but does that mean no one should study, you know? Does that mean that, so in his view, anything that doesn't produce and is utilitarian is useless. So if it's expressing emptiness, if it's, of course, economics, business, computer science is also an expression of emptiness. But as long as we seek to produce and accumulate and consume, we're going away from this place of full potentiality. We're filling up rather than emptying. I'm just looking at my... and it's, yeah, so this also has to do with addiction, which is a really common phenomenon in our day, right? So we fill ourselves up so we don't feel empty. And we can fill ourselves up with content on the internet, with food, with drugs and alcohol, with exercise, with tobacco, with, you know, all kinds of things we fill ourselves up with, right? But once we've engaged in that process of trying to fill ourselves up, we feel more empty. And that's where addiction comes in, because it's, as I said before, it's never enough. So we become addicted to it because we need to keep producing, to keep filling ourselves so that we don't feel that emptiness. And the thing is, if we really somehow, all of us here, made that step across the threshold of willingly seeking to experience emptiness, because you sit on the cushion and that's what you're experiencing. You get caught in your thoughts because your thoughts are trained not to experience that emptiness. But we're trying to retrain, as it were, our being to not get caught and distracted and fill up, because we fill ourselves up with our thoughts. We fill ourselves up with our anguish, with our worries, with our fears, with our anger, with the, you know, all of this, we fill ourselves up with it. So yeah, I'm just looking at these things. Right, and so, you know, because our culture sees this emptiness as negative, we just then hurry to fill ourselves up so that we don't feel that horrible feeling. What we think is the horrible feeling. And I know myself, who as a child wrote poetry, and then as I got older, even as a teenager I wrote poetry, but then as I kind of started entering the world, and, you know, having to be a consumer and a producer and support myself, and, you know, in college, basically, poetry kind of got pushed to the side, and I began to experience it as, you know, the place of emptiness, which didn't fit with the rest of what everyone was telling you had to do. And it became a frightening space. And this was not conscious, but it became a frightening space, poetry. Because it wasn't concrete, because it didn't make money, like we say, because it didn't give a position in society, because it didn't engage with people in argument and prove me wrong, you know? You can't, the poetry has nothing to prove, and it can't be proved wrong, which actually is, when I came back to it, is why I loved it so much, you know? And I'm speaking as a poet, but you all can experience, you've all experienced this in various aspects of your lives, I'm sure. Things that aren't utilitarian and productive sometimes give us the most joy, in fact, usually give us the most joy in our lives. Just the fact of being, you know, of not being something else. And it's not to be, you know, our culture is like become, you know, so that you arrive somewhere. It's being. Someone on Friday night, I mentioned this in the study group, I was at a gathering with a lot of people who I've known for 40 years. And one of them, who left, moved back to the US, but was there, said, "How is your daughter?" Because he knew her when she was like 5 years old, 5 or 6 years old. And I said, "Well, you know, now she's 36 and she has her own child and whatever." And he said, "You know, I remember her. Do you remember this story? That story about her?" Then he was going to tell me that I said to her once in some gathering or something, I said, "Behave, Morgan, behave," because I don't know what she was doing. And she looked at me and she said, "I am being Have."
Which, behave.
What does it mean?
Well,
behave.
Behave means to
suissage. Being Have.
It doesn't.
Oh, okay, no, it's not like a meaning. Okay,
no.
Okay.
It's like you would say, "Be good."
Yes,
okay,
okay,
right.
Okay.
Be good. And then she would say, "Well, I am being good."
Okay.
So behave, as she said, "I am being Have." I don't remember this, but he did, and he has never forgotten it in 30 years.
Did you tell Morgan?
I did. I told her this yesterday. She doesn't remember either, but I thought, wow, you know, that's really interesting that a child would be so, you know, attuned to being, you know, she's like being, because I think children are more attuned to that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think she was taking it like, "Be what you are," or something. And, "Well, I am being Have." And when we do the Jukai ceremony, you know, the teacher says, "Be one with the Buddha," and then everyone else chants back, "Being one with the Buddha." We could say, "Be Buddha," and then you would say, "Being Buddha." It's like this non-separation. And that is like anathema. That is like contrary to everything that the culture around us is telling us to do. We're supposed to behave. We're not supposed to behave, right? We're not supposed to being anything, right? Because then it sounds like you're stuck somewhere, right?
Just cave on.
Right. What is the British thing? Stay calm and.
Heave on.
What is it, Tiago?
Carry on.
British thing?
Carry on.
Be calm and carry on?
I think so.
No?
So.
Stay calm and carry
stay
on.
Calm.
Stay calm and carry on. Right. Don't be
don't
anywhere. Right. Right. Just carry on. Or like the French thing is like circuler rien à voir. So, how wonderful that a child is capable of that, and loses it then eventually. Right? We're all capable of that. We were. When I was a child writing poetry, it wasn't like I was writing poetry. I was being poetry. I didn't question it, It never occurred to me anything about poetry. It was just, that's what I was. And then when I started becoming, right, into this culture where, oh no, you have to be something, and confirm, it's even like, in the Christian religions where there's these rituals that you do, and one of them is confirmation. I think it is in Catholicism too. No,
mm-hmm.
Anybody know? No, whatever. It is in Protestant, right? Yeah, I know. I did it. It's a confirmation. I don't really know what we were confirming, but I guess like we found God or Jesus or something.
Did you go to a training? I went to a training.
We go through training so that we can confirm. That's right. Well, our whole culture trains us to be confirmed.
It's the same.
It, yeah.
In France, yeah, it's like,
yeah. In Catholicism?
Yeah.
Yeah,
your first Holy Communion, isn't that?
Well, there's communion.
There's still confirmation.
But for that,
they have confirmation. Yeah.
For those of us in the Protestant religion, there is no communion. Right. No way. this notion of being is so powerful, and so it can speak to us when, if we just, yes, the cat is also being. when we sit, if you look at it and you say, well, this is just being. Just sitting. That's why we say sitting. We do say we will sit, or I am sitting, but it's just sitting. That's what Bernie's thing was. And the cat's like looking at me, wondering what I'm doing here. Never sit here. So it's like, Bernie's thing of just sitting, and then he would scream it because it's just sitting.
Is that Shikantaza?
Yeah, exactly.
You should all see Debbie's watch. I'm sorry, it's distracting me.
Debbie's watch?
I couldn't find a real
being
one.
Being time.
So I got one of these,
she's
but it's
watching.
A little bit too tight, so it's cutting off my circulation. It's 12 euros at Pigeon.
This is Debbie's watch. Being time.
Being
cat time.
Time.
Cat time.
Cat time.
Being watching.
Being
right.
Time. Right. The 100 euro ones are so...
Well, yes. And so this is also an interesting phenomenon. Yesterday at lunch, there was a discussion about the watch that... The football player who won the big prize, the best football player of the year, who plays for the Paris team. And so it's a big deal in France. And in all the pictures, his watch is very prominent. I didn't notice it really. But of course, if you're into watches, you notice it, And in that world, they're into watches. So my son-in-law said, oh yeah, he even knew which watch it was. And he said the name, I don't know what it was called. And he said, you know, it costs like $250,000.
What?
That watch, yeah. My daughter looked it up. $330,000 euros this watch cost.
Of course.
And I thought, wow, you know, okay, these guys, these football players, they make so much money that they have to do something with it, you know. And they have like fancy cars that then they die in, as in Portugal, or they, you know, have a million watches, and I don't know. But so
give it away.
What?
You could give it away.
Well, and they, some of, a lot of them do too. Yeah, they create foundations and stuff like that. But and they support their families because usually they come from backgrounds that are not, you know, very wealthy. And but so this notion of like spending money on a, something that keeps time, that is like so, so much of our moment, you know, that we, you know, we accumulate, we want to possess and accumulate and fill, and money is a representation of that. And then we create objects that we can obtain with that money. And among those objects that are the most attractive, so we said fast cars, you know, fancy fast cars, personal airplanes, you know, so private jets, watches, you know, something that keeps time. Like, because actually, you know, the only absolute way to, the only method that puts an end to our feeling of emptiness in this, you know, in the world of accumulation and everything is death. So, and that is also, you know, it seems perverse that that's what scares us so much, because that's when we will no longer be able to fill up the emptiness. This is all unconscious, of course, but, and so we keep track of the time, because it's very important to know how much time is left, or we want it to go faster, to get it over with, whatever this boring moment is, we want it to be done, or, you know, we don't want it to go away. So we have these, we invest all of this, this, you know, whatever we've accumulated into a piece that keeps time so that we can escape the end of needing to accumulate. Really crazy, you know? It's really crazy, our world. Our practice is radical in that sense that we have a timekeeper who helps us to function in the relative world, because we need to function in this relative world, and which frees the rest of us from having to think about it and having to have expensive timepieces. Even that, you know, that clock on the wall over there, I took out after the first sitting period and put it outside because it was really annoying, that tick, 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 tick. Because it was like keeping me in the time, you know? I don't know if anybody else noticed it, but the clock on the wall over there was ticking during the first sitting period. I had forgotten that when we did the days here before, it did that, and we used to take it off and like put it in a drawer or something, so... and was keeping me in the time, and my own relationship with time, just as a personal thing, was that I really had a problem with time before I started this practice, and I worked in a job which was all about time. You know, there's deadlines all the time, and strict deadlines, because if you didn't have that article in the newspaper, it didn't get into print, and the paper would be late, and it cost a lot of money, right? If the paper was late, it cost more. And so I was very attuned to those deadlines and things, which in that sense I appreciated as a constraint. It was very creative to have that constraint. A limited time and space, which was very creative. But at the same time, at the same time, I didn't want anyone to tell me, to do something at a specific time outside of that, you know. And I really didn't like rules, and I didn't want it to be free, and I didn't want anybody to, you know, cramp my style. But it was because I was, you know, didn't want to feel the emptiness. And time was a way of facing that end of time, and I didn't want to face that, right? So I went just about a few months before I started this practice, I went on a vacation to Morocco with a boyfriend. And when we landed in Marrakesh, Fez, I took off my watch because I was on vacation and I didn't want to think about it. And he had arranged everything and rented the car and the hotels and everything. And I didn't have to think about anything. And I took off my watch. And that 10 days in Morocco was so powerful. I think I was like having an experience of this practice before I even did it. On the beach in Essaouira, which is just this amazing place, Essaouira. And before Essaouira has become what it has become now, apparently it's like a super tourist attraction, but it wasn't then. And I came back to France and I never put the watch on again. Never. I still have the watch. I keep it as a memento, but I never put it on again, and I've never owned another watch. I experienced in those 10 days the freedom of not carrying and obsessing about time, you know, not having it on my wrist all the time. Now, of course, we have our telephones, and so we always have it with us, but I don't use it as the way I did with the watch, and I don't feel it in that way anymore. And when I then, you know, like a few months later started practicing this, found this practice, and having had another, you know, really powerful experience about it, it became so clear to me, you know, that there is no time, in fact, you know, it's... time and space are part of the relative world, of course. That's a way of expressing and experiencing the relative world. But as we know, it's just now. It's always just now. When we're seeking to accumulate and fill up, then we're involved with time and space. But when we're experiencing the impersonal, the emptiness, there's no time and space. And another cat has arrived. So. Oh, and she wants to drink my water. No. So I don't remember where I went off on that, but it was about timepieces and time, and how we. It's really ironic that we would fill up our emptiness with objects and activities that will lead us farther and farther away from experiencing who we truly are. And we empty ourselves of the substance of who we really are by filling it up with other substances and covering it with other substances. You know, and we have these koans, so like, you know, Joshu, who a young monk comes to see Joshu and says, please, you know, I've arrived from such and such a place, please teach me. And Joshu says, well, have you had your breakfast? And the monk says, yes, I have. And Joshu says, well, wash your bowls. So, you know, on a very just prosaic, pragmatic level, after you eat something, you wash your bowl, right? But on this more deeper level, it's if you filled yourself up with something, empty yourself. You can't receive any teaching if you're full of something else, right? Or the you know, the famous story of the two monks who are arguing about the flag. Is one is saying the flag is moving and the other one is saying the wind is moving. And the sixth patriarch comes along. Nobody knows that's who he is because he's gone off wandering and living a hermit's pilgrimage life because he had to flee his monastery where everyone was engaged in competing, right? And killing and hating and disagreeing. So he arrives in front of this monastery and he asks them what they're talking about. And one says, well, this guy says it's the wind that's moving, and I say it's this flag that's moving. And the sixth patriarch said, it's not the flag that's moving, it's not the wind that's moving, it's your mind that's moving. The flag, the wind, all is just being. Competing, and the cats were having a little dispute over there about the scratching board. So,
is that what the
scratching
is?
Board?
It's the scratch.
No,
yeah, it's where they scratch.
That's right.
And they each tend to sleep on there, too, at different moments. So, there was a little conflict about it. So you see, there's conflicts about territory. However, then one just goes away, and the other one stays there, and everything's fine. So.
Is it always the same one that stays on the...
It depends.
Okay.
The one who's there now is really the alpha, the alpha cat. But sometimes she wins too. Muji wins too sometimes. Wins to stay on. Being, right?
Catting.
What?
Catting.
Catting. Flagging.
Having.
Winding. Right. What?
The mind
moving. Mind. Minding, you know. That's an interesting one, minding, because, you know, we say, mind your own business. Well, I am minding my own business, you know. Minding the children, or minding, whatever. Minding the gap, as we would say in the UK. Minding, being, you know. And the sixth patriarch is great for these things. You know, he's the one who when the guy chases after him, the monk who is like the equivalent of Charlie Kirk and wants his, you know, disagrees with him and wants his position, catches up with him, and the sixth patriarch just puts down the bowl and the robe and says, take it. If you can, take it. And he tries, but he can't. Sometimes it's interesting, you can envision it like, you know, it's like so heavy or it's locked to the ground or something. He can't take it, but he can't do it. He realizes he can't do it. And so he's like, you know, please teach me, you know, or I didn't come, he said, I didn't come for the robe and the bowl, I came for the teaching or something. And so he says, before a thought of good and evil, so before any dualistic thought, having, not having, having, not having, wind, flag, you know, before any of that, before, what is the true face of Monk Mio? Monk Mio is this guy who came. So before anything has been added, before, what is there? Who are you then? No. And the monk, you know, we've retained this story in part because he has some great realization or some realization of who he truly is. And then says, you know, brother, you're my teacher. You're my teacher. He said, no, I'm not. We have the same teacher. If that's true, if you truly realized what you realized, go back and be with that teacher who was their teacher. They both had the same teacher. So all of these koans are pointing at this. We fill ourselves up with the good and the evil. We fill ourselves up with right and wrong. We fill ourselves up with getting, spending. You know, there's a famous 19th century quote from like an American philosopher. I think it's Emerson, but it's, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. This was in the mid-19th century, which means that to lay waste our powers means to waste, to not fully embody who we truly are.
What are the two things, spending and what?
Getting and spending, which is the tale of our moment even now. You know, it already was in the mid-19th century in frontier America, you know, or colonial America. And it is today, getting and spending, we waste who we truly are and what truly is life. And the getting and the spending is involved with filling up the emptiness, filling up what we experience as empty, as nothingness, you know. And we have, so there's also the thing of, you know, is the glass empty or is it full? Well, it's neither, you know. We can engage in, you know, arguments. So another thing about this, another engaging in arguments, I think immediately of these film clips I saw yesterday. So another one of them was that, because he was super anti-trans, this guy, it was more like in a debate setting. It looked like it was maybe a college debate club or something. They were sitting face to face. And there was this kid with like super long hair, really smart, sharp kid though. And so the guy says, Kirk says, so what's it, give me a definition, you know, the definition of a woman is a human being with two X chromosomes. Give me your definition of a woman, he says to the kid, you know. And the kid said, a woman is someone who identifies as a woman. And Kirk says, how can that be, or something, whatever. And the kid said, right now, if I choose to identify as a woman, I'm a woman. And both of their positions is, you know, I understand where the kid is coming from. And in a sense, you know, he's in lining with kind of what our practice is, in the sense of the full potential. And woman is just a label. So, you know, we can, or man, or tall, or short. Of course, there is those differences. But from the emptiness perspective, we are all of that. And we can manifest as whatever is here and now. And if someone manifests, says, I am manifesting now as a woman, well, that's what they are. And this was kind of what the kid's argument was. And the other guy's argument is purely scientific, which we know only takes us so far as well, you know. It doesn't take into account emptiness. It doesn't take into account the nature of being. It can give us the facts of being, but it doesn't take into account the nature of being. Scientifically, I don't think there's any way to prove the experience I had in Morocco when I took off my watch. There's no way to prove that scientifically. However, that's my experience, and it changed my life. Changed how I experienced the world, experienced how I manifested in the world. You could say, okay, I became someone who doesn't wear a watch. But that's just a fact. That's not what the experience was. So any of our scientific proofs and arguments are valid within that context. but they're not, they don't have the same, it's like apples and oranges, as we say, you know, they're not the same. And I would say that from the position of being, emptiness, the experience of emptiness is the experience of full potential and all possibilities. So it embraces the science, whereas the science does not embrace the emptiness. This is all very simplistic, what I'm saying. I'm just trying to give concrete examples in the relative world of what it means being, you know. And emptiness. Being, you know, let's see if we can get any other. yeah, so, you know, and in art as well, it's like there's the, that the emptiness is absolutely essential for creation. You know, if Tiago sits down to make a pot and there's already a pot there, or if he, you know, he, not that Tiago makes so many pots now, but if he's, you know, trying to, he has to look at the object that he's repairing from an emptiness perspective so he can see the whole thing. Otherwise, he wouldn't be able to repair it. If he only sees the broken part, he won't be able to work with it. All art, you know, or music, or, you know, film, or anything, it comes from this emptiness place of not knowing as well, right? But not only art, everything we do comes from that space. It is that space. It is that experience. It is that. That's why we say, you know, catting or being or scratching or whatever it is. Being have. I'll have to, you know, I'll have to really thank my daughter for that one, because that's. So I guess I'll stop there, because that's a long talk. If anyone wants to share, comment, question, anything.
Hello everybody, Tiago. It's just because I don't know to say in English, c'est quoi le jeûne, c'est quoi un jeûne?
Fasting.
Okay.
Fasting.
Yeah, I fast for the first time like 2 weeks ago, and it was a really strong experience. I really didn't, and if, I don't know why, it really related from with what you say, because first of all, I didn't know I was able to do that, because for me it's like if I miss one meal, I'm like, I could kill for a meal. I mean, if you don't give me to it, I experienced that on a boat. When I left on a boat for 1 month, and we were 4 on the boat, and we were in the Pacific, and we didn't have enough to eat on the boat, and we could eat just a very small portion for 1 month, and I lost 10 kilos on the boat. And I remember that it was really tough for me. It was really, every day was tough, because I don't know why. Just to eat a small amount for me was, I don't know, it made me, and when I came back, I fell very sick, because the first day I could eat, I ate a lot, because I didn't handle to my frustration, so I had a lot to eat the first day, and I've been very sick at the end of the day. So it reminds me that, and since that day, it's for me to fast for 3 days, it's impossible. I don't know, I think I'm going to die or something. It's like really tough. And but that time I really had a pain, a tough pain for 6 months.
And I read everywhere that the fasting was the solution for that. And so I decided to fast by myself, and it was, I don't know why, it was super easy to fast. If you follow the program, it's easy. And the fact is, I didn't know that, but at first you are very tired, but on the third day, there is an energy. It's like if you have been eaten for 3 days, it's like a huge energy coming from nowhere, I don't know. But you're like if you had eaten, So you feel very, a strong energy. And I thought it was so interesting because I thought I was going to be more and more. Each day I was going to death. So I was going to be in my bed and I wouldn't be able to move. But no, it's just the first day you feel like that. And the third day, there is energy is coming from somewhere else. So it was so weird because I was, it didn't happen what I was expecting. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that the pain is gone. I mean, the pain left, it was true. I mean, I don't have the pain anymore. So it's amazing. So, okay, that just, I wanted to share that because it was in a way to empty myself, but as a matter of fact, it's true, something new came instead of that that emptiness, I mean, physic emptiness, right? It's not, but it's somewhat, it's related with the spirit because something happens to my spirit, to its, maybe because the pain left, so maybe it was relieved. It was, I don't know. I think it was like space in my head. It makes space in my head. I don't know why. Because just the fact to not eat made space in my head. So I wanted to share that. And yeah. And my koan is form is emptiness and emptiness is form.
Okay. Okay.
So it's,
I did not know that. Okay.
That, you know, that's an example, a really concrete example of when we don't fill ourselves up. I mean, that's, you know, literally not filling ourselves up with food. There's something else. There's space. There's something else that happens, you know? And we know that what we do put in our bodies does affect our mind as well.
I have to say something very important. Sorry, I forgot something. One thing is... And the fact is, I spend my day eating and cooking because I cook everything, because I eat without gluten and everything. So I have to cook a lot because I cook for my breakfast, but I cook for my lunch that I take to my play, to my job. And I cook for the dinner and I cook for my son like that he can take with him. So, and I didn't have to cook anymore, so I had so much time left. I was like, wow, I have so much time. What I'm going to do with all this time? You know, it was amazing that I understood the time I spent to eat and to...
And shop.
And shop, to eat and shop, and think that what I'm going to cook, and you know, it's amazing. Okay.
Precious. And on top of it, the inflammation went down, so you don't have the pain.
And I don't have the pain.
So that's just a concrete example of what happens when we don't fill ourselves up. I mean, we also know it from sitting, you know, experiencing the emptiness in sitting. So.
I'm very worried, I must say. I'm very attached to my watch. That's all.
So why are you worried about that?
Because of all you said. It was just, this is the only thing I wear. I don't wear jewelry. I don't wear anything. It's the only thing I wear. And it was given to me. And I've had it for 30 years, almost. And I need to know the time. It's the one thing. So, what does it mean?
Well, no, I mean, I'm not like, you know, trying to take on the watch industry and tell people that to watch us by any means, no. I just think it's interesting to look at, yeah, to pay attention. And for me, I was kind of a prisoner to my watch, so.
I'm really wondering, how much does your watch cost? Tell us. Maybe
that's right.
It's a very expensive one.
Well,
this,
she did. It was 15
euros.
12 euros.
Well, that was the whole problem with this watch thing. If I don't know what time it is, I can get lost, and all of a sudden it's 3 hours have gone by. I don't have good time stuff. So I want to be able to check it, and the telephone thing is you have to go into your purse and all that. So the other day I said, since my beautiful watch, I have a beautiful swatch that you can't tell what time it is because, of course, because there's a second, you see all the mechanisms of the watch. It's very pretty, but what time is it? And as a matter of fact, to the point the other day I thought, maybe I've been wearing this upside down because it stopped. At dance class, I thought, Debbie, have you ever been wearing this wrong? But it was just that it had stopped at 3 o'clock. It was 9 o'clock or something like that. So I said, okay, I got to go attack this problem because if you don't tell me, it could be 3 p.m. or except for the light, I'm not good about this. I worked very hard. I was always on time at school. I could never figure it out. It was sort of like, it was more ignorance than resistance, although there was resistance. It was because in Paris, I never lived in a big city, so I'd say, okay, I'm going to meet somebody at 3 o'clock. I'll leave at 3 o'clock. And I know that's not right. So if I had two rendezvous in the same day, I'd get there at 3 o'clock, had to leave right away because the next one was at 4. Like, how do you do this? The places I lived in, it was right there. So I was all messed up. So finally, after being insulted by a friend of mine who said, we were sick of you, I said, okay, get a watch and figure this out. It's not rocket science. So I need to have a timepiece. Then I go downtown and it's $150 for these horrible, what is the point? They're not pretty, they're not interesting, they're not anything. So that was out. And I know that Peter Dunne has these because I've already had one before, except I went like this and the thing went across the room and that was the end of that. So anytime you're interested, see? Except that it's so tight on me, it's cutting off my circulation. But, you know, that is kind of a... But you can, wear it wherever. Hey, that's not a bad idea. I might do that.
Well, we might also remark that Debbie's socks say, it's never too late to do nothing.
Well, I have a real... Oh, yeah, can I... Well, wait a minute.
No.
We can see the...
You can see it?
Yeah.
It's never
too
late.
To do nothing.
I bought these for the Sangha when I saw them because doing nothing is not, you know, how do you do nothing? That's what my practice has been about.
So yeah, you know, I mean, it's really has meaning for you, that watch, because it helps you be.
Yeah.
Helps you being here
confused.
Now, right? So. There's nothing wrong with watches, you know. It's just interesting that, like we say, you know, that we would invest so much.
That's what's written on the back of my Rekusu too.
What is it?
What is it?
It's not what you do but what you stop doing that matters.
Yeah.
It's the same conundrum.
That's right.
That's that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Can I just say something quickly?
Yeah.
It's interesting about the watch that you were just saying, because I use the watch so I don't look at my phone. So my addiction, let's say, it's the phone, and I've been blessed with a broken phone last Tuesday. So I am without phone since last Tuesday, and it's like freedom. It's an amazing experience of no notifications, not having anything calling to me every time, and of course then people want to call me and it's difficult. But yeah, it's it has been a great reminder of what I was being stuck with. Does that make sense? And it's a bit like what Lisa just said about the rakusu. It's like when I stop doing that, what is there? What was I stuck to? So yeah, it's just funny with the watch, because I use the watch, so I don't look at my phone, and that to me is is the freedom of it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And in the same way that there's no problem really with the watch, there's no problem really with the phone, but it's how we use it and what we do with it that is problem. And that's another, you know, phones, people invest a huge amount of money in their phones, and there's always a new one and another one and another one. And then, you know, I try to not be in that race, but at one point, after X amount of years, it was obsolete. I had to get a new one, you know. So, yeah, interesting. I might need the plug there, because it looks like it's dying. I put the cord there, didn't I? Didn't I put it on? Oh, no, it's there. I don't know if it'll reach back there, though. We just have to plug in the computer. Oh, good. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, we're about out of time here. Speaking of time. So I guess we'll end there. Should we do the vows? Mm-hmm. Should we turn off the sound for that?
What?
Oh no, if we turn off our sound, they can't hear.
Mm-hmm. Put it back.
Quarter to three, maybe. Yeah.
I don't know if they're.
Are you coming
available
back in the afternoon, or? Yeah. So that would be 1:45 for you, Tiago, and you go. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Excuse me. I am.
Should I turn it off? Yeah.
Well, thank you.
See you soon.
Attends,
I...
Il a dit merci.